shine over the earth, and we're trying to look up above and trying to see as much as we can. That's what we're attempting to do here. Instead of really digging into certain passages, certain chapters, we're trying to do an overview, tell the story of Scripture from the Old and the New Testament. And we're basically in the third lesson this morning. This past Sunday, we looked at the big problem, which is sin, which was found in Genesis chapter 3. We try to set up the stage. In other words, that once man sins, that really changed the whole dynamic of what God had originally intended for man. God didn't want man to sin. He didn't want him to be in a state of shame, a state where he's in a bad fix, if you will. And talking about that, so Genesis chapter 3, I suggested is one of five key passages we're going to be looking at in the Old Testament, and I kind of want to keep referencing this so you'll keep thinking about it, because I think these five key passages really kind of pivot or pinpoint the main places in the Old Testament that kind of show or demonstrate the story. And I've only revealed the first one, which is in fact Genesis chapter 3. And it's that idea that God and man are separated. And we saw how God, of course, drives man out of the garden. There are four other key passages in the Old Testament that we will be looking at, and I kind of remain those hidden until we hit them. But I'm going to kind of repeat this until you get sick of it, or sick of me mentioning it anyway. But I do hope that it'll at least, I guess, implant in your memory, so that you can kind of, when you think about it, when somebody asks you, well, what is the Bible about? What is the story of the Bible? You can think about these five passages and say, well, the first one at least is about God and man being separated. And of course, the rest of the Bible really kind of pivots from there. It's about how God fixes this problem in the Old Testament. Tonight, I'm going to dig a little bit more into this idea of sin and talk about basically chapters 3 through 11, which are the consequences of sin. If we were to kind of look at the outline a little bit of the book of Genesis itself, we've already seen like the first two chapters that tell about creation. God creating man. This is creation as God intended it to be. Man is the crowning achievement, and we saw various things about man. The fact that he is in the image of God, that he has dominion, that he is to subdue the earth, he's in paradise, that he has fellowship with God. We saw those things, those key elements about man, what makes man so special. And then in chapter 3, we see the idea of sin coming. Man and God are separated. There we go. There's my sin graphic. Sin comes in. And then chapters 3 through 11 in the book of Genesis basically are describing for us, this is what sin has done to man in a number of different ways. And we're going to be looking at those things tonight. I really want us to see how sin has affected us in a very real way. But Genesis is telling us that there in those chapters, 3 through 11. So let's kind of recap. You probably already know the story of those chapters, but I'm going to kind of hit the highlights here very quickly and then really talk about the consequences of sin and some other things connected to that. So in chapter 3, we have the fall of man. Adam and Eve sin and are driven from the garden. And then in chapter 4, we have the story of the first children that are basically from Adam and Eve. And who are they? All right, so we have the story of Cain and Abel, and of course, their offerings to God. Abel's sacrifice is accepted. Cain's is not. Cain becomes jealous, angry, upset. He kills Abel. And of course, as a result of that, and we'll talk about this more, Cain is even driven further away from God. He's driven from the presence of God and along some other things as well. Then in chapter 5, is basically a genealogy. That is, it tells of the descendants from Adam to Noah. And it you know, typically we kind of just skip over those chapters, right? We you know, all those long names, and it just seems like a boring kind of set of verses for us to kind of really dig into, because it's not necessarily telling a story other than the fact that this person had this son and so forth and so on, except and they are important for a number of different reasons, but one in particular is this chapter, and we emphasized this last Sunday, is that with, except for one exception, as it talks about the age of the person, there's a phrase that's repeated over and over and over again in this chapter. After it mentions the age and how long they lived, what happens? And he died. Yeah. Over and over and over again. Again, you'd think that would be kind of redundant and obvious. Well, somebody lived so many years, of course they're going to die. But the whole point of that chapter is the fact that man wasn't supposed to die. But now, generation after generation after generation, there's only one exception, Enoch, man dies. And that's the condition of man. Then in chapters 6 through 9 is the story of the flood. Man becomes so wicked, God repents, some translations say. Other translations say that he was sorry that he made man. And so God decides to destroy the earth with a flood, save for Noah and his family, in which God provides a way for that family to be saved. And so we have that whole story, how God, in essence, tries to... really, the idea here is God tries to recreate the earth through Noah and his family. In other words, sin had become such a problem that God decided, you know, I've got to do something. Sin needs to be dealt with. He deals that with the flood itself, and then basically decides through Noah to try to, well, recreate man anew. And we'll have some more to say about that. And then in chapter 10, there is another genealogy. It tells the descendants of Noah. And the emphasis here is through the lineage of Shem. Remember, this book, Genesis, is written by Moses, and he's writing it to the Israelites. And so he is emphasizing here things that would be most of interest to that particular nation. And so what he is ultimately doing, as we're seeing here, is that he is sort of starting with Adam. He is focusing on that lineage that is closest to the Israelites. And in this case, it would be Shem, who is basically of the three sons of Noah. It is he that the Israelites come through. And then in chapter 11, we had the story of the Tower of Babel, where man attempts to create a city and a tower that would reach the heavens, and of course God strikes it and strikes man and confuses the languages, and we'll have more to say about that. But that's basically an overview of those chapters, and you kind of look through there, it talks about that, well, except for the genealogies, but even including part of it, I guess in chapter 5, the genealogy there, the emphasis here is the things that man has done wrong, the sin and the things and the problems of sin that man has faced here. And so for the remainder amount of time, what I'd like to do is look at these chapters and talk about the consequences of sin, and really kind of think about how the Bible sets up really why sin is such a problem. In other words, why is it that God is so determined to save us from sin and its consequences? Why is that such an important thing for God to do? Well, it's because sin is so serious. God never intended sin to be part of man's life. But here it is. Here's what it's done. And so there are basically 7 points we're going to be looking at. And what I'd like for us to do, as we look at each particular consequence, and we're going to talk about it a little bit, but I also want you to think about, and we'll also discuss, how Christ reverses those consequences. In other words, the purpose of Christ coming in and actually changing those consequences into, well, basically eliminating the consequences and providing us the opposite of that, or the blessing that he came to relieve us of those things that sin had brought in. So I want to think about some, perhaps some teachings, passages that relate to these things. So for instance, the first one is pretty easy, and it's found in chapter 3 when God told Adam and Eve not to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. There was a consequence attached to that. What was the consequence attached to disobeying God about eating the tree of knowledge of good and evil? Death. In that day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. And so we see that the first consequence of sin is death. The wages of sin is death. Well, why is that? Well, I guess there's a number of ways of looking at it, but I think the predominant one is that God is life. And violating God's law, we'll look at the next point as well, but separates you from God. But ultimately, God basically says, I'm not going to strive with man forever, and he'll die. We saw also that in addition to the tree of knowledge of good and evil, there was also another tree that is specifically mentioned in chapter 2 of Genesis, which was what? The tree of life. And man had access to that tree of life, correct? God wanted man to be able to have life until he sinned. And we also saw in chapter 3 that one of the curses, the reason why God drove man from the garden specifically was for what reason? Yeah, he's become like one of us, know good and evil. Unless he reach out his hand, take of the tree of life, basically we're going to drive him out of the Garden of Eden. And he does that. The very reason, specific reason that is given in chapter 3, so that man would not live forever. And we suggested the idea that perhaps it was a blessing as well as a punishment. In other words, God is simply protecting man in one sense so that man would not live in sin perpetually, but he does drive man out of the garden as a punishment as well. So the idea that death. Well, let me back up here for just a second. Have you ever heard, and perhaps we even said this ourselves, that death is a natural part of life? Have we heard statements like that, where you know that death is sort of a natural course of events? Well, I like to kind of challenge that idea. Death is not natural at all. In other words, it's not part of God's creation. It's a consequence that God has established, but God didn't want man to die. It's a result of sin. Ultimately, death is not a natural thing. It is very unnatural, and God did not want us to die. So, how does Christ come in, and how does he reverse that particular punishment? Any thoughts on that? Okay. Okay. All right. So Christ gives us hope of eternal life. And of course, the Gospel of John is a great book, a great gospel that emphasizes that idea. You think about the many statements that Jesus talks, that uses it, and he uses the word life or eternal life, where he says, I am the bread of life. Or how John opens up in the first chapter, how he describes Jesus as the Word who is the light of man and the life of man. Jesus truly came to bring life to us. And kind of back up just a little bit here, when we talked about death, death in Genesis chapter 3, I made a suggestion. Was it just spiritual death, or was there also physical death under consideration? In other words, when God is talking about death, is it just spiritual, or is it also physical? I think it is. It has to be, because the body dies, and what's one of the things that Jesus promises, in addition to spiritual life, he also promised physical life as well, the resurrection. I mean, that's 1 Corinthians chapter 15. If there is no resurrection, then our gospel is in vain. Paul basically argues in that particular passage. One of the key fundamental teachings about Jesus. And what we're hoping for is that we will have a resurrected body. That our body that gets sick, decays, dies, suffers, that it will be raised, glorious, incorruptible, and be able to, well, be the kind of body that Jesus has. We do not see Him as He is, but we will see Him when He's revealed. We'll see Him like He is, and we'll become like Him, is what the Scriptures talk about. So that idea, the first consequence of sin is death, but Jesus comes and He's going to reverse that for us, promising us life. Now, the second thing that sin does, not just sin from Adam and Eve, but every individual sin, is the idea that sin separates man from God. Spiritual death, we call that. And really, one and two are practically the same. If we're separated from the life of God, we are separated from God. We die spiritually, we die physically. But sin ultimately separates us from God. Well, why is this significant? Why does this demand our attention? Well, it's pretty clear, and we talked about this, that God desired to fellowship or to dwell with man. Our God is not a God who is just sitting high above the earth, just watching things from a distance, kind of just observing our lives. No, He wants to be a part of our lives. That was His intent. And He created us to have a desire to be with God as well. It's interesting. I'm not an anthropologist, and I don't play one on TV, but I kind of am interested in that field of archaeology, anthropology, the history of man, and that sort of thing. And anywhere you go on earth where man has been, you will find tremendous amounts of evidence of man trying to reach God in some way. Either worshiping a God or a group of gods, you know, depending. But man everywhere has attempted to worship someone greater than himself. And, you know, where does that, if you want to call it an instinct, or where does that impulse come from? I think it comes from our very creation. God created us with that desire to worship Him. And when man sinned, man felt that separation. In fact, and I mean, kind of jumping ahead here in just a moment, the very first thing that we see after man is driven from the garden, the first story in chapter 4 is of Cain and Abel. And what are they doing? What are they at least attempting to do anyway between those two men? Yeah, they're offering something to God. Now perhaps, and I would strongly suggest that perhaps God communicated the need to do that, but they're doing it. And at least in Cain's case, when he realized he wasn't doing it right, or God wasn't pleased with that, he was upset. I mean, he's got some emotional stock in that effort to offer something and be pleasing to God. And he gets upset when he is not and takes it out on his brother. And throughout Scripture, I mean, which is basically as old a history as we can find, you see man worshiping God in an attempt to try to strive to find God in some way. And it's there. I still believe, as even if our society very often is trying to distance themselves from God, and man has very often tried to put the God out of their mind. Romans chapter 1 talks about that, how although they could know God, they chose not to know God for various things. Man still has that void, and he is separated. And strives to find ways to fill it, either through other types of religions or it could be some other things. Man wants that connection, and you know, there's only one connection, that, of course, is Christ. And so, how does Christ come in, and how does He cure that problem for us, or how does He solve the problem of separation between us and God. All right, he becomes a sacrifice, which in effect does what, Brandon? Okay, exactly right. Kind of break it down a little bit. What is it that separates us from God? Sin. How does Jesus address that? Through his sacrifice, providing forgiveness of sin. But there's also more we could say about that. He's not just our sacrifice to be the one who suffers the consequence of sin for us. In other words, he suffers the first point. He suffers death for us. So that we don't have to face that. But what else does he do to bring us closer to God? What is he? Or what's another description of Christ in addition to sacrifice? Right? He's our mediator. 1 Timothy chapter 2, first few verses talk about that. There is one mediator between God and man, the man Jesus Christ. And that idea... and we're going to talk more about this, about who Christ is. In fact, there are a couple of titles, if you want to call them, that describe Christ. One is, he is the Son of God, but he's also, in fact, what Jesus calls himself more often than not is what? Not the Son of God, but he calls himself Son of Man. Yeah, exactly right. He's both. He is God's Son and man's Son. And he is able to bring God and man together. And of course, I think the statement in John 14, you know, where the disciples ask, you know, show us the Father. And Jesus, you know, have you been with me so long that you haven't seen him? You know, it's that idea. Jesus came to declare the glory of God. John chapter 1 describes there. So sin separates us from God. The third point, and that basically comes to the story of Cain and Abel, is that sin ultimately destroys our relationship with our fellow man. Of course, this is the story of Cain and Abel. And we know the story well. Cain is jealous of Abel. Cain kills Abel in chapter 4, tries to hide the fact when God confronts him there. But that's a literal consequence of what sin does. That relationship is destroyed. Or you think about other types of sin. I mean, how many families have been destroyed because of the sin of adultery? Not just husbands and wives, but you know, families, children that are involved here. That sin will destroy relationships. Or I don't care what sin it is. Whether it be thievery, whether it be not honoring your father and mother, I mean, it could be just any of those typical commands that we think about, or that sin that's involved, and how it has a way of destroying relationships. Sin, in general, is a destructive force. There's nothing good about sin. There's not one thing that you can say where there's a positive about it in a spiritual life. Sin is destructive, and it destroys humanity. It destroys our relationships. I've seen it destroy congregations. I've seen, in my own life, I've seen, you know, my own sin that has harmed and hurt loved ones and friends. And I'm sure that you could say the same thing about your sin. And we have to understand that it has a very real impact in our lives. So as we think about that, how did Christ basically broach that particular consequence of sin? How does Christ reverse that consequence? When you think of some things that Jesus has taught that helps us along these lines. Okay. All right. Absolutely. So he is the perfect sacrifice. He himself lives sinlessly. So how does that help bridge the relationships that are broken because of sin. Think about some specific teaching that Jesus offered about when sin somehow separates you from somebody else in your life, whether it be friend, family, or whatever, and how he specifically deals with how to resolve that. Yes. That's one example, absolutely. Did you have anything more to say about that in particular? But yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example. What Brett was saying, the idea, you know, when Peter asked the question, you know, how often should I forgive my brother? And, of course, Peter offers another seven, and Jesus responds, no, 70 times seven. Of course, that's not literal. I mean, Jesus is simply demonstrating there is no bounds to your amount of forgiveness. And sometimes what we forget about forgiveness is about restoring relationships. It's not just about the idea, I'm not going to hold something against you, but it's the idea that whatever separated you in that relationship, now it's no longer there, and that relationship can be mended. You think about our relationship with God, it's based on forgiveness. But what does the forgiveness do? What is the result of that? It's about our restoring of a fellowship or a relationship with God. That's what it's intended. It's not just forgiveness. It's the idea of being one with God. With man, you think about the various things. I mean, Jesus talks about doing good. Or how about teaching about with our enemies? I mean, what types of things are you talking about? Those enemies that may very well have it in mind to sin against us, cause us harm. I mean, what types of things did Jesus say our attitude or our dealings with do with that kind of person? I think that's exactly right. Doug was basically illustrating that teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, you know, turn the other cheek, you know, go the extra mile. And then really in those passages, the idea here is if someone imposes on you, either by committing a sin against you or taking advantage of you, instead of you retaliating in some way, you do the opposite of that. You don't sin against that person. You do something good instead. Go the extra mile. Turn the other cheek. Or we're not to hate our enemies, we're to love our enemies. And love is an act thing. It's not just an emotion, it's the idea of doing good. And so you think about it. If sin destroys various things, it destroys our relationship with God, destroys our relationship with our fellow man, Christ comes in and he basically not only reverses those things, he teaches us how we can reverse the consequences of sin in our own lives. Whatever it may be, whatever sin that we have caused, whatever sin others may cause, we are ones who do good to basically be salt and light. Or that just popped out of my head. I had another thought here and kind of escaped me here. But it's not an actual idea of, I know what it was. One of the things that we're called. We're called peacemakers. That's one of the characteristics of people in God's kingdom. We do good to build relationships, to build things that are positive in this world, not negative. So we think about that. I think we have to be conscious of the idea that sin, anytime we sin, it's going to destroy something. and it's certainly going to destroy a relationship with God. It may very well destroy relationships with our fellow man, whether it be family, friends, or otherwise. Now, this next one, you're going to kind of have to give me a little bit of leeway, and I think be too radical here, but it is talked about in these chapters. I think we have to discuss it. But it's that idea of sin destroying our relationship with His body. I'm not a tree hugger. I'm not an environmentalist. I don't go, I don't go around saving the whales and that type of thing. But some things for consideration. I mean, God did create this world, and His creation is beautiful. He created it for us to enjoy. And yes, I'm talking about the trees and the mountains and the oceans and, you know, all those things, the animals themselves. I mean, those things have a beauty to them. God intended them for us in such a way. But man has a way of, or sin has a way of destroying those things. And that's demonstrated. In other words, when man sinned, when Adam sinned, one of the curses was that well, now Adam's going to have to work from the ground. There'll be thorns and thistles. That's going to be a very difficult thing for man in many respects to have to deal with it, basically to live. And that's even furthered by Cain. When Cain sins, he's furthered away from God. And also there's the additional mention of the ground being cursed for Cain's sake. In other words, even harder for Cain. And I take that also from his descendants as well, as man in general, that would be a difficult thing. And just one quick thing. Our family, we went on a senior trip with the students from ABS and went to New York. And New York's an impressive city, but it's ugly, to me, anyway. I mean, some neat things about it, and the skylines that are pretty, but you get in to New York, and it's concrete, it's asphalt, and there's not a whole lot appealing to me. And New York is basically built on, if you allow me the oversimplification here, it's built on greed. It's man wanting something more and more and more of, and most cities are. It's man's attempt to I guess demonstrate his ability to build things, and it's usually never. I should be careful about oversimplification, but rarely is it motivated by good intentions, by godly intentions, and so typically things that man builds are destructive to the environment. You know, when Jesus wanted to be close to God, or let me rephrase that, when He wanted to be alone and spend time in prayer, where did He go? Yeah. Or the Garden of Gethsemane. I mean, he went to places that basically were the Creator's hand was evident. Not necessarily in the city. I'm not saying that you can't be close to God in the city, and that's not my point. But there is something to be said about that. Now, here's the difficult part. How does Christ reverse that consequence? I have a hard time coming up with one necessarily, except for the idea, perhaps, that ultimately the reward is the real paradise with God that we will be able to enjoy in some way, perhaps a way that we, you know, can't even fully comprehend that Christ will restore. So I'm going to kind of leave that. We've only got a couple minutes here, and there's two other ones I want to talk about. And that is the idea of sin becoming universal. In Genesis chapter 6, after it talks about the sons of God and the sons of women and the children that they had, it then describes, if you would open the Bible real quick, we haven't actually done much of that. We've been talking about it, and looked at some verses, but in Genesis chapter 6, in verse 5, all right, so I don't know precisely how much time has elapsed between creation and the fall of man and this point here in Genesis chapter 6. But how bad had sin gotten in chapter 6, verse 5? Yeah, yeah. God, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Of course, it was so bad that God decided that he would destroy the earth. Sin is universal. Romans chapter 3, verse 23, right? Or is it 13? Yeah, 23. That what does it say about sin? Man. Who has sinned? Yeah. Everyone. All have sinned. Sin is universal. I saw an illustration, and I have to be quick about this. A way to prove that there is sin. Anybody have a set of keys on them? You don't have to prove them. I actually have one here. What does a key do? This is a door key. It's not my house, but somebody's house. I won't tell you how I got this, but I'll just let you be curious about that. But what does a key do? What's it for? What's that? Okay, it could provide access for some, but it also does what? Okay. Why would you lock a door? Do y'all lock your doors when you leave? What kind of person do you keep out? Exactly right. Someone who has sinful intentions to come into your house and take things or do things that you don't want them to do. That's proof right there that there's sin in the world. You have in your card, a wallet, these cards with the magnetic strips. You know why those are there? Keep people, well, there's a whole story I got about that, but to keep people from stealing things from your account. Keep your information private, supposedly, although people can get that as well. But there is sin in the world. People that have designs on doing bad things. So sin is universal and it's everywhere. So how does Christ reverse that? Any thoughts on that? What's that? Okay. He certainly wants to limit sin. He's teaching us not to sin. And ultimately, there will no longer be sin. I mean, there'll be judgment. But it's one of the things I thought about. Like in Matthew chapter 28, after his resurrection, before he ascends into heaven, the command that he offers his disciples is to do what? The Great Commission. What is that? Go into all the world, do what? Preach the gospel, make disciples. Isn't that one way that he's trying to reverse the effects of universal sin? Absolutely. To teach others about himself, his lordship, his Christ. Now the last one is an interesting point. The bell's going to ring here in about a minute or so. There we go. That sin is recurrent. Once sin had entered into the world, even by God's attempt to destroy the earth, did that solve the problem? In other words, well, he destroyed sin, started with Noah, problem solved, right? No, sin happens again. What happens? Well, I don't have a whole lot of time here, but basically, Noah plants a vineyard, gets drunk, and there's some unseemly sin between him and one of his sons, Ham. And even after the flood, we see sin time and time again. And Christ tries to reverse that, so that at one point in time, there will be no more sin. Sin will be eliminated. I think it has to do with judgment and resurrection. And that will be take place. And then the last one, sin brings social disruption. That's what the Tower of Babel is. Sin does not benefit man. It destroys man. That's what wars are all about. And fightings and bickerings and that type of thing. And the Tower of Babel is about man's attempt in order to elevate himself, perhaps in his pride, his arrogance, tries to reach God, and God strikes man with the confusion of languages, and just completely says, we're going to deal with man in this particular way. But Christ tries to bring that. He tries to, as we talked about earlier, bring peace, to show man how to live harmoniously with one another, and he does that through the church. The church supposedly the idea is a model of what God wants for His people. And we should be living peaceful lives in unity. All right, I'm sorry for dominating the conversation. Any last thoughts, comments, questions before we stop here? All right, next Sunday, look at Genesis chapter 12, and we'll be looking at the promise that God makes to Abraham. We'll stop there tonight.